Welcome to Flip Your Lid with Kim Honeycutt. Kim is a psychotherapist and executive director of ICU Talks, a mental health speaking ministry. This is a podcast about how to flip your lid and learning how to reconnect to who you really are.
Okay, hi, wonderful Flip Your Lid listeners. I am really, really excited and just honored to be able to sit here today with Michael Shahan. He is a therapist, Enneagram godfather. Like he just knows so much. He and I can both talk about polyvagal. We can talk about all the therapy nerd things. And so he has a huge following on Instagram, and he is worthy of that because he is sharing so much amazing wisdom and ways for people to be able to not be against ourselves, before ourselves. And because of that, we can be for other people as well. So Michael, welcome to Flip Your Lid.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm glad you asked me to be here. This is exciting.
Yeah, this is really good. So, you know, we're just going to jump in there. And the only thing we know we're going to do is me ask this question, which is tell us a little bit about what flipped your lid and what measures have you had to take to reconnect to who you actually are?
Man, I think it's kind of a hard question for me because if we're saying that flipping my lid means disconnecting from who I am, then until the last like year or two, I have almost always felt disconnected from myself. So it's not, there's not really a moment that I remember early on in life or something that flipped my lid and disconnected from myself. It's just the last several years of my life has been a slow reconnecting to myself in a lot of ways. Does that make sense? I don't know. I don't think that's true, but I always grew up, I had just a lot of my own patterns had to do with me shutting myself down from myself and disconnecting from who I am. And it's been very, very difficult in the last few years, especially the last about year of reconnecting to myself and, you know, the consequences from that, good and bad and everything in between. Yeah, it's been quite the journey, but what was the question? How did I reconnect to myself?
Yeah. What's some ways that you help self-regulate?
A lot of breathing exercises. I teach my clients a lot too, like twice as long out breath as in breath a lot of times, right? Like two in, four out, three in, six out. A lot of breathing, a lot of breath work. And what I have found the most, it's not any sort of head game exercises, like try to go to a happy place in my head or try to think these things. It's like, cause I can't disconnected, when I'm spinning, when I'm anxious, my brain won't do that. And so it has to be somatic.
Right.
A lot of breath work. Lately, in the last few weeks, I've been going on walks and just kind of feeling my body and paying attention to what's around me and feeling that kind of, I can more and more able to feel that sliding out of that anxious spinning headspace and into this sort of present grounded body space. And it's just really recognizing what that feels like and what it feels like when I'm not there. And actually, the last few weeks, I have this app on my phone called Yap. And I have it, it'll randomly send reminders to me throughout the day. And so it's this, what is going on inside of me right now? And that is sent to me like six times randomly throughout the day. So it causes me to pause, take a deep breath and check in what's going on and just throughout the day, be aware of what's going on internally. Cause that's really what regulates me more than anything, I think, kind of bringing back to the present moment and focusing internally.
Yeah, I think you've already just fed our audience just the question coming from the app. The fact that we need to be reminded
to
check in and see, am I actually in my own life?
Yes. Am I here? Am I present? Am I here? Or am I in the future? Or am I in the past?
Right.
Versus, And it's such an interesting question because a lot of times it'll pop up, what's going on inside of me? And I'll say, I have no idea. Oh, wait.
Yeah.
Let me check. And then the more I practice, the more it's almost easier it is to get to that place of what's going on in me? Am I present? How do I get present? And being able to describe it and know what I'm feeling and know how it feels. Is it a sense of ease? Is there a sense of panic? Am I spinning? Where do I feel that? It's been a really, really interesting exercise for a while for me to do. And I'm really, really grateful that I started doing that.
Yeah, that's good. You know, David White, just to paraphrase his.
I love David White.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Love David White.
Without Suzanne Stabile, I probably wouldn't know, but I was in a conference with Suzanne Stabile and she screamed at me in front of everybody. She's like, you order David White's book right now. And no one can talk to me like that, right? But I'm like, ma'am, yes, ma'am. You know? And so, but I love his definition of maturity, which is maturity is holding present, past, present, and future simultaneously in your hands, basically.
Wow. Okay.
Right?
Wow. Yes.
Yeah. And so just the idea, because trauma Trauma means I can't be in the here and now. Mm-hmm. Trauma stops me from being present, right?
Yes.
And future means how do I be the future self, the higher self? And so just to speak into that, if you can, about your journey of learning, how did you even figure out? Because we do it in increments, right? How did you figure out, like, you mentioned a year or two ago that, oh, I'm actually not here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not present.
Mm-hmm. So how did I figure that out?
Is
what you're saying? Like, was it even the process of...
Did something happen that you hit bottom on that? Did someone tell you, like, hey, you're disassociated all the time? Like, how did that even come to fruition? Had it become evidential?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I would probably have to point back to grad school for the first time ever, which was 2015 is when I started. Uh-huh. So I was basically in a room with 23, 24 therapists or future therapists, right? Mm. All very caring people. And I remember there were a few times in grad school where I remember thinking, like, this is the first time I've ever fully, fully shown up somewhere and felt loved and accepted and appreciated by people.
Wow.
And just a few weeks into grad school, I was like talking with people, and the topic of parents came up, and I had a lot of like really, really hard stuff a few years happened before with my parents. And I remember crying as I was telling the story to a few people on lunch break. And like feeling really embarrassed about it and apologizing. And this one lady who actually works right down the hall from me now, which is so cool.
That's amazing.
She said, thank you so much. It was an honor of you. It was an honor for you to share your tears with us.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, what? Why? What is that? Why would that be? Why would you even, I don't know. And just to feel appreciated and accepted and wanted and loved and not judged by like a group of people. When I was able to, I think that opened up so much in me. Cause that's right around the time I started my own therapy journey. I'd never been to therapy before.
Gotcha.
And just able to, I don't know, practice this. I think it always just hidden internally and within a lot of shame.
Right.
Expecting people to judge me. And then it was almost like I tried not hiding for the first time and it went well.
Well,
it's like, wait, this is not at all what I expected this to be like. I feel so accepted. And that opened up. That safety opened up more ability to explore myself, right? Because it wasn't really safe to explore myself before, but that safety gave me the permission, the ability to start opening up myself. And that's kind of really when my journey of growth started, was grad school in like a really big way.
Yeah.
And I really, really think it probably started with just the safety in this group of, in this community of people.
Yeah.
It did a lot for me.
Yeah, I'm so glad it landed well, right? And they got to be safe for you.
Yes.
So let me ask this, because I know you specialize in Enneagram, and I already know you're a 9. You know I'm an 8. And so those of you who are listening, you understand that overall, the term is for 9s, which I disagree with in the sense that y'all were peacemakers, right?
Peacemakers, whatever.
Yeah, because I think it's that it's, well, this is my question. Help me with this. So the definition of fawning, trauma response fawning, is to do something for somebody to avoid conflict so that you can feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
That is also the definition and description of an Enneagram 9.
Yeah, it's a huge pattern. Yep. Wanted to keep everybody sort of soothed. I can only be okay if everybody around me is okay.
Right.
Kind of like defending myself by keeping myself safe, quote, safe, by keeping everybody around me okay.
Right. By avoiding the conflict, not even getting there for the conflict. Yep. So it's just my heart goes out because like that's for people there, like you're constantly in a trauma response.
Yes.
And encouraged to be there.
It's almost applauded, celebrated,
yes,
right? It's not like some addiction that makes a big splash, right? Like alcoholism or drug abuse. It's like my defense mechanism that actually traumatized me further and further of choice was responded to with, oh, you're a really nice guy. You're like really fair. You really understand. Yeah. It's like, yes. Yeah. And like, that's actually a defense mechanism in a lot of ways. And I didn't even realize that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that cool, common, collected can actually just mean that someone's underwhelmed because they're living in dorsal vagal because they're
hypo-regulated. Yep.
Right.
It's with clients all the time, I see that, especially like a lot of times the male in like a couple system, he thinks he's emotionally mature and regulated. What's actually happening is he's just shut down.
He's just shut
and
down.
Disconnected. It's not like a sign of maturity a lot of times, like people think it might be.
Yeah. And so many things that I think you're specialized in are things that are considered past for normal, past for okay, and that you've experienced in yourself and that you're speaking in and speaking out about like, hey, like, let's call this what it is.
Yeah. That's a great point.
Yeah. It's really, really good. So how's that like that level of vulnerability that you have now because you're speaking publicly so much since that one time at lunch with everybody in graduate school, right? Like that's a path of vulnerability.
Sure. So like how is it when now that in life, when I'm vulnerable, it's to way more people than just a group of—
Yes, it's a whole lot more people now.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
It's been just as scary as the first time, I feel like, with each stage that I've like grown it in, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Right, like, I mean, the first time I ever did an Instagram Live, I was absolutely panicking. Mm-hmm. Just, yeah. Not so many people might see, and what do I say? And even now when I post things, I still really think about how it might affect people, and I get worried. It feels vulnerable, and can I share that with people? Is that too much? Is that, it's hard. It's really difficult in a lot of ways, and is that it's kind of you're speaking to, right?
Yeah, like how to be grounded in to know like that this is okay to post, and this is, and how are you dealing as a nine when people, because it doesn't matter where I post, someone has something to say that's
oh man, not
right?
Well,
yeah,
how I would answer that question. At least a while back, I remember like one of the first times I got like a lot of first few times I got any sort of direct feedback, like this is bad, or I can't believe you do this, or this is, there would be this instant like, oh, well, that's why I never wanted a big Instagram account. I better shut it all down.
Right.
Like I could feel physically my stomach would just plummet to the floor is what it would feel like. And I would just feel tingly and almost shut down when it would happen. And wanted to just quit it all and hide, like this desire to run and hide basically. But it's interesting. Sometimes I'll get really angry.
Yeah.
I'll get angry and like, what do you know? Or share with somebody, or I feel this urge to like, I don't know. Yeah. So what it is, a lot of times I've had people directly message me before, like, I really don't like this. People will say this is a stereotype and it's unfair. Like, well, it's a meme. So of course it's a stereotype. Like, I don't know what you want from me.
True.
Actually, I could say that to so many people.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to a friend of mine who's an eight. His name's Amanda. And I was just talking about this lady, like reach out, and I had this urge to like fight back, like explain myself. Oh, I didn't because she basically was saying you're misrepresenting eights and everybody does this. And then I remember she was kind of getting curious with me, my friend Amanda, like, what is it about that upsets you? Mm-hmm. And it really went back to this like, oh, she doesn't know that I understand her, that she doesn't see that I'm a good guy. She doesn't understand that.
Gotcha.
So it's all these like defense personality mechanisms that I couldn't make work in that moment like I normally can.
Yeah.
And then she asked me the question. I said, I want her to see that I care and that I understand. And then my friend Amanda said, how much of that do you have control over?
Yeah, that's good.
And then it hit me. I was like, none. Right. And I felt a sense of relief and a sense of panic at the same time.
Right.
Like it's a beautiful truth that's uncomfortable, right? Like it's, I don't have control of this lady. I can do I could put so much effort into letting her know who I am and that I really do understand. But I could do all that. And you can still reject it.
Yeah.
There's a freedom to that and a panic at the same time for me in that moment. I remember feeling that really strongly.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So my wife today was looking at your account and just reading stuff. She knows more about the Enneagram than even I do, and she's just amazing, and she's a four. And so she showed me the Enneagram 8 post that you had, and it says, Enneagram 8, it can feel very vulnerable to not speak their truth, ask for help, appear soft, easily influenced, make a mistake. She says, is that true? I said, that just made me very nervous as I put that away.
Really?
Right?
Don't talk about that.
What are we going to talk about that for? Put that away. No one needs to talk about me feeling soft. All right? She's like, oh, well, that's my answer. She's like, that's all.
Perfect.
That's all I needed. Right?
It's interesting how different things for different people are vulnerable. Like for an 8 and a 9, some things that are vulnerable can be exactly the opposite. For me to speak my truth can feel extremely vulnerable. Just like
isn't
for an 8,
such a good
to
point?
Not speak their truth can be just the same amount of vulnerability and fear internally.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that's such a good point. I love the way you put that. Part of what, and it's not that she and I struggle about this, but if we were in public recently at AT&T and this woman was caustic and was interrupting our time with the customer rep and was demanding to be seen in front of 20 other people. And this person working there was a 24-year-old woman who drove five hours that morning just to work there. So I've got compassion for her, and I'm wanting to speak directly into this woman in a loving way about her interrupting us. And she stopped me, and I will perseverate on that because I didn't have a voice, because I didn't take action about something that to me is now a social justice issue. It becomes everything, right?
Yeah,
just the different perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Such different perspectives. But like in my brother, my twin brother is an 8.
Yeah.
And so it's just interesting throughout life, like the ways that we have direct, like how we've handled things so differently and what's vulnerable for me. Mm-hmm. And I remember just understanding him and him understanding me a few years ago, realizing like a lot of frustration that he had that I didn't speak up and that I, and I remember telling him like, I think it's as vulnerable for me to speak up as is for you to let go of control of something or not mm-hmm. speak up and then, or to be vulnerable or to be soft.
Yeah.
And then that hit him and it was like, that's how hard it is for you. And it was such a cool moment of like understanding, like it's a different context, but that same vulnerable fear.
Yeah. What a bridge of connection. Do you, how much do you think you got influenced by, you know, your brother being himself, right, as a little boy, and I know we can appear differently, you know, as a kid when it comes to numbers and all that, but but him speaking out and saying stuff like you watching that, or maybe watching the hardship on teachers or hardship on your parents, and how you interpreted that, how much do you think that played out to you feeling comfortable as a 9?
Oh, yeah, I think it played a huge part. Like he was the 8, was the assertive or the aggressive type, and so I think just growing up, like, so my dad, my brother and my older brother are all assertive types, a 3, a 7, and an 8. And
oh, wow.
So I didn't have to speak up. They would always take care of it. And so like almost like I didn't need to practice that. I didn't have to do that because I knew it would be taken care of. Or if I tried, it would be threatening to them.
Right.
And they would be upset with me. And so I learned very early on, like, oh, I guess I can't speak up. I guess just almost even more and more believe in that narrative that I can't speak up and it's not allowed and all those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, honestly, it's made me a great therapist.
Yeah.
I'm great at listening and great at empathizing, right?
Sure.
It's almost like that. I can look at that as a weakness if it's turned up too high, but it's also given me an incredible ability, so much practice in empathizing and listening and setting my own self aside, which is required as a therapist a lot.
Sure.
And so it's almost like set me up well in some ways.
Yeah. Yeah. I love all that. So what did the Enneagram practice, the spiritual journey of Enneagram, bring into your internal template, your private practice as well, that other modalities and other things out there did not?
Oh, wow. A lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I that's why I combine the Enneagram with therapy so much. I teach a course for therapists on how to use the Enneagram. It's a 6-week course because it's so, when I first started learning about it and using it, like, this makes perfect sense. How does everybody not use it in therapy? It speaks to underlying motivations. It makes the unconscious conscious, which is basically what therapy is in a lot of ways.
Yes.
And a lot of, so are you talking, when you asked that question, are you talking about like my 9-ness or just the Enneagram in general with that, like how it's, can you repeat your question actually?
Well, now way too much time has passed. See, I'm a forward thinker. I don't even remember what I asked. So, like, done with that.
I think what I heard you ask was, like, about how the Enneagram sort of affected my own, you said, internal template or inner template, like my own spiritual
just
journey
how it,
and growth.
Yeah, just how your internal composition, how it helped you as a therapist versus learning about internal family systems or learning about polyvagal or anything else.
Okay. Yeah. Because I combine it with all that stuff. In my course, I talk about combining it with polyvagal and IFS and EMDR and all this stuff. And it's it's not necessarily, I wouldn't call it the Enneagram, how it's a modality in itself, but more a lens on how to look at people and how to use those modalities, right?
Absolutely.
Like, there are 9 very, very different ways that people look at the world around them.
Yeah.
9 very different filters. And if you don't realize that, you can, I think a lot of people will try to do therapy for their clients in the way that they need therapy without staying curious about, like, right, for my 8, like, for my 9 clients, I need to, like for my 8s, it's hard work for them, for me to be gentle and soft with them and call that, like, that's hard work for them.
Yeah.
But for 9, like, yeah, it's just, it's different how I approach client work. It's almost like a map, not like a map for work with different clients and for myself as a therapist. I know as a 9, I can really panic at conflict. So this is it's probably a great example of this podcast. If I have high conflict couples, or if I have couples in my office that are arguing, I'll find myself holding my breath, like leaning back away from them. And then just knowing that as a 9, I can have such a hard time with conflict, and it can feel so just physiologically scary and threatening to me. And so just recently I had that happen. I felt my back usually starts to sweat when I get panicky like that and nervous. Right. And so I was like, wait, okay, I'm panicking, I'm nervous, this is okay. This is actually probably important that they talk this out. This doesn't mean I'm failing. We're going to be okay. And just reminding myself, coming back to the present and not doing therapy or continuing on from that reactive space. If I need to calm this.
Right.
But like I can use that part of me to calm it or soothe it or mediate. But when I'm reactively having to use it, I think that makes me not a great therapist because I'm not. Right. Does that make sense? I'm
being absolutely
driven by that versus utilizing those parts of me when I need them.
Yeah. No, I think that's very well said. That makes perfect sense. And I've heard people say that they think being an eight, not talking about me, this saying in general terms, okay, that how can an Enneagram 8 be a good therapist? And I think I'm a really good therapist as an 8 because I don't get commingled with your emotions in what you're experiencing. I truly believe you can carry this, right? Wow. I truly believe I can be beside you in it, but I'm not going to do it for you. I would never do it for you, right?
Sure.
Right, and so I can have a long day with clientele or patients, and I can just, outside of like horrific tragedies, right? Like I can just walk away and still stay in my recovery, my life. And I think it'd be harder to be a dependent stance and be a therapist than an aggressive stance.
Yeah, sure. I think, I mean, it's its own, definitely each has its own struggles and own challenges, difficulties, because the eights have that defensive mechanism of denial and compartmentalizing things. And so it's easy for it, natural for you to just walk away from that, which can be great.
Yeah.
And sometimes, but I could see some ways it could be not as helpful, right, in certain therapy situations, just like me. Like there's a, I remember learning a while back, just after grad school, about this balance of, what is it called? Not approachability. I forgot the language for it, but as a therapist, there's a need to be accepting and non-judgmental for whatever happens, and there's a need sometimes to push into uncomfortable things. And conflict, directness, something, right? To have that balance, to do both. And I think as a nine, I have this sort of invitation, welcoming, non-judgmental down easily. I can do that in my sleep. But what's hard for me that I've had to develop over the years is the confrontation part. Like, this is important. This is why they're coming to me. I have good insight. This is why they need to hear these hard things. And so it's okay for me to do that. Whereas some eights, on the other hand, it's just easy to challenge all day.
Right.
Sometimes without the invitation, it can leave people feeling uncomfortable.
Sure.
Versus, it can be great.
Yeah, it's a good distinction because there has to be a relationship there. It has to be knowing.
Yes. And if you're all conflict and super direct and like maybe people don't feel as safe with you.
Right.
Maybe you have great stuff to say and you'll say what other people won't to them. But if they don't hear it, then what good is it?
That's exactly right. Yeah. Because we have to be in our essence, in our adult space to have any movement. And so that's part of it. That's part of why I love being a therapist is that I'm so encouraged. Just like your app coming in saying, are you here? Like it's the same thing. Like, I have to be present because, you know, people, those of us who are traumatized are incredibly intuitive, but we also say in a trauma response, I'm reading the room a little bit too much. So they will know if I'm not present.
You're saying your clients will know if you're not present?
Yeah, so it's great.
Yeah, what do they see? Can I ask that question? Can I ask you a question?
Well, I think I do a good job overall staying connected, but if I walk in and I'm still a little bit, haven't quite washed off the last interaction, or I just responded to a text or something and I haven't quite transitioned to them, they will be very evident about that. And they'll ask me, are you in a good mood? I'm like, yeah, I'm in a great mood.
Oh, they can notice?
But I'm in a great mood, but it doesn't mean it looks the same on me as it looks on them.
Sure.
Right? And so us getting to know each other and them being okay to check in with me, but me saying, like, I really need to make sure that you are aware that us to pursue what you're seeing in me, is it what you walked in with? Or am I now in the mother role? Which is very easy as a therapist to be put in the mom role, right? We're taught to be the good enough parent for them.
Interesting.
Yeah, which leads into attachment stuff, which I don't think enough therapists have taken the time to research it. And I know that you're very well versed. And so how have you seen attachment injuries and your knowledge of attachment theory come into play for you with your clients?
Man, it's even the last few months. Again, I feel like just in the last year, I mean, I could talk a lot about that. Just a lot of growth exploding in me in lots of great ways, lots of life altering ways. But I'm learning a lot about how anxiously attached I can be. And seeing what that looks like and knowing what my work to do is in an anxious attachment space, it helps me understand clients. Like for me, like when I'm in that anxiously attached space, it's these people are never going to come back. If I let go, if I let go of control, they'll never come back to me. They don't like me anymore. I have to like move toward them. Yeah. And my work is to take a deep breath and trust that they'll come back. If they care about me, they'll come back. I don't have to make it happen. And even my trying to force it to happen will arguably make it worse on their end, especially if somebody's like avoidant, right? And the kind of avoiding the sort of pursue, withdraw cycle. I'm going to push somebody away, and it's going to be this self-defeating prophecy, self-fulfilling prophecy, self-defeating action.
Yeah.
And just, I think learning how that plays out in me and seeing the actual thoughts that I have when I'm in that spiraling place and how I talk to myself and how I believe other people think of me, like, the more and more I see that, the more I'm able to step away from it and say, oh, that's that anxious, attached part of me. That's probably not the truth. I don't think I can trust that right now when I'm in this space.
Right.
When this,
right.
And then so seeing it with clients, just being able to speak to anxious and avoidant and however that looks for them. I don't know. It really helps empathize, helps understand how I think one of the, whether somebody's anxious, avoidant, or however their attachment style looks, that, how do I put this? It feels so true in those moments that somebody's leaving and they're never coming back and they don't care about me.
Wow.
And so it feels like God's honest truth sometimes that I'm really in that really scared place. And then knowing that feels so, it feels so rational and real in the moment.
Yeah.
And so being able to speak to clients whenever anxiety, maybe they're in a more of an avoidant client and their fear is that they're going to be engulfed and taken over. So they have to have their space.
Right.
And just like knowing how real that feels for them. Like they truly believe when they're in that triggered space that they're going to be smothered and never be themselves again and lose their sense of self. And it's just, it's to empathize with how real that feels has been really big for me in the last few months, especially because it can feel so scary.
Yeah.
And it's, but lately getting into a place where I, just the other night I was spinning about something and I actually had this thought like, wait, this is how I spin. I don't think I can trust this right now. I don't think this is actually me and my best self. And then immediately after realizing that, took this big breath and then it was gone. I was like, I will revisit this tomorrow because right now I can't trust any of these thoughts. This is not going to be helpful. I'm not grounded right now. And just knowing what it feels like to be not grounded and know to not make decisions or trust how I see myself in that space is huge.
Well, even all of what you just said, like that's in a sense like 6 months of therapy for people. And the vulnerability with that, because we really aren't taught that it's okay for us to be vulnerable as therapists. Right? And so that's so real of what you just said and just share with people. And the idea of being able to check in and say, you know, have I felt this before? Is this an old story?
Right? Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Is this really comfortable? And so in that moment, I'm going to believe everything the thoughts are telling me, right? All the parts of self that 100% come in.
They feel like the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you call that out to like your clients if you see yourself spinning? Do you ask them to give you a second? Or are you able to do all this internally?
Yeah, it depends. Sometimes internally, sometimes it depends on the relationship I have with them because I like modeling that for them, right?
Yes.
Like just yesterday, I had a couple, a client, and I was sweating. I told you I was sweating.
Yeah.
And near the end of the session, I said, hey guys, is it hot in here? Or am I just sweating because I'm uncomfortable with the conflict? Because I had told them that before.
Yeah.
Because the husband's a 9, and so I've shared how they can feel, and he's really related to that a lot. And I just directly said, like, is it actually hot in here, or am I having like a physiological response?
Right.
And they said, it's actually really hot in here. I was like, okay, cool, we're good. But speak that directly with my clients. Like, I remember just, I don't know, 2 years ago, maybe 2-3 years ago, I had a client. I always tell my clients, if you're ever upset with me or all of a sudden are hurt by something I said or feel like I was shaming you or anything, I want you to let me know. You have full permission. And then I had a client say, I was really angry at you for what you said. This is even a better example. This was this week too. I had a client say, I was raging at you since our session 2 weeks ago. You told me that I have to do all this on my own and this and this and this. And my first thought, I felt this immediate ball in my stomach of fear. I was like, oh no, I upset them. I did something wrong. I messed up. I'm bad at this. I was like, wait, hold on. And I have something about just my work lately or something, I was able to see that, oh, that's not actually what I told her, but her wound is exactly right. What I told her was, it sounds like your work around this is to really find out what you want and be able to ask for that. And what she heard was, you need to go and figure that out by yourself.
Right.
And that's what she heard because of her own wound.
Yeah.
And I was in a regulated space enough to not say, that's not what I said.
Yeah.
Or also, not go to this place of, I'm so sorry. Oh my God, I'm so sorry. And that makes it about me.
Right.
At one point in time, I almost said, I feel like a huge jerk, but then I stopped myself because that's making it about me.
Yeah.
It's making it about, that's almost inviting her to feel sympathy for me and get out of her own. And so I was able to know that in the moment, be that, and just like stay curious with her. Like, can you tell me where you heard me say that? What was that like? What's it like being angry at me? And it was a really cool session. It was, and then at the end of the session, and then even around the middle, I said, hey, I want to check in really quick how my response to you sharing those wounds felt. Did you feel heard? Did I, did you feel like I was making excuses? And I said, I would like to handle that even better if there's a way to do that better in the future. And I don't think I would have been able to ask that question and invite that had I not been in a more regulated place. And then at the end, I told her, I said, I felt this pit in my stomach earlier and I felt angry at you, right, when you said that. But I realized that was just a defensiveness and a reaction from the fear, and I don't actually see that anymore. It makes sense. Yeah, it was a really, really cool session.
That is such beautiful and powerful modeling.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that's so incredibly important to model that. Mm-hmm. It's like that gives them permission to say hard things to people and practice it and to be heard and to model needing to regulate and the stories that I have and how I got mad at you. That doesn't mean you're a bad person. Doesn't mean I hate you. It means I was reactive in that moment.
Yeah. This so much can coexist.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly. So good. And so in speaking of story, let's segue into polyvagal. Tell me a little bit about how you got introduced to polyvagal theory by Dr. Stephen Porges and just how that's been a powerful tool for you.
I can't remember how I got introduced. There's a therapist that I work with downstairs. She owns the practice. I worked there for years. She was the one who taught me about it initially.
Yeah.
Because I don't think we learned about it in grad school.
No.
I read, what was the book by Deb Dana? There's another.
She's got three or four, maybe five books.
I read one of those and just really seeing how it clicked a little bit in me, but it was really kind of kicked off me when I started combining it with the Enneagram. That the other therapist that I work with, we actually created a course once for like the Enneagram and polyvagal theory, like the polyvagal ladder, how there's nine different looking ladders for each number.
That's so good.
It's a different threat that sends you down the ladder, and it's different narratives that are developed in different ways that each number tends to, what's the word?
Just perceive and interact. Just their understanding of it.
To combat those narratives what's the phrase I use? I forgot what it is, but I mapped out each sort of ladder for each number. I think the shutdown space looks the same for each number.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think nines can go to that shutdown space quicker in a lot of ways than other numbers. Mm-hmm. But just mapping that has helped so much, just guide the work of a client, help them sort of befriend their nervous system, right? I think that's, I don't know whose phrasing that is. I don't know if that's gorgeous or...
Probably Dana.
Is it? Yeah. I think that's probably,
Because I don't think Stephen Porges knows how to say things simply.
Yeah, sure.
He's brilliant. He can't say it in a way anybody can understand it, right?
Yeah, in any way that's not dry, you mean?
Dry, yes. I was trying to be nice, but we'll go with dry. All right.
I don't think it's accurate.
Sure. Yeah.
Combining with the Enneagram has helped a lot, for sure. It's really cool to help map that out for people. It's so much normalizing, I think, happens with polyvagal theory, especially. Like, hey, this is what happens. You're a nervous system with hair and skin, basically. Yep. Like you don't need to, it can take away so much shame for all our sort of trauma reactions. Like that is your body and your brain, your nervous system trying to protect yourself. It doesn't mean you're a bad person. There doesn't need to be a sense of morality attached to your shutting down, or you're not good enough for shutting down there's so much normalization that can happen of our own responses and trauma responses and defense mechanisms through polyvagal theory.
It's absolutely, absolutely true and well said that, you know, like our system is created to exactly what it's doing.
Yes.
And then we go into society and culture who, because everyone else is already traumatized and they're also in their own functional freeze or high performance or hyper aroused, whatever it is, no one recognizes that, like, we have to have a lot of encouragement and modeling, like what you're doing, and being public about it, to know that there's actually a sense of self in the present that we can get to.
Yes. Yeah. I love that a lot.
Well, you may have done this with clients, and this is, you know, I learned this from, you know, Dave Dana, but this is so powerful. I'm sure you do this for your clients. And so for those who are listening, like, to think of the person that anchors you, and it could be your dog, it could be a grandparent or your current spouse, there's somebody that really lets you feel connected, and think of a time you laugh with them, and there was just such a connection. And that's being able to sit with that and then intentionally go into a sympathetic, intentionally go into some stress, right? and then come back to the connection.
Kind of.
Yeah. We don't think, we think if we go into it, we won't come out. And we actually can go into that. We can go into dorsal vagal, come back out, come back into fight, come back into self. It sounds simplistic and it's not for people, but it's an amazing process.
Yeah. And sort of in theory, I guess, an idea, it is sort of simplistic, I guess, but we just don't, it's hard to, I mean, especially the more sort of emotionally, I don't know, volatile and intense our reactions are, the harder it is for us to separate ourselves from those reactions. And when we're in it, we just can't see it, right? We don't see how it's affecting us. We think we are those reactions.
Right.
And,
right.
It's going with clients. I went up before when I prep clients for EMDR. Do you talk about, I'm assuming you've talked about that on this podcast.
Yes, we have.
I always do the resourcing stuff. We create a safe place, or sometimes a safe person, or a safe object, or a container. And when we have that figured out, we practice it. So I'll say on a scale of 0 to 10, right? Like 10 being you're totally freaking out, 0 you're calm. What puts you at like a 3?
Right.
Think about that, and now let's practice using that resource. And it blows people's minds like a lot. Like how I'll do it with them, and they start feeling like when I'm stuck in traffic, I get to like a 3 or 4, and they start feeling that in their body. I'm like, okay, now go to your safe place. What happens? And it just shifted.
Yeah.
And then what's so cool is I always point out, I'll say, did anything get better in your life outside of this room during this 30 minutes that we did this? No, but your nervous system calmed down. You felt safe.
Right.
So you have so much more control over that when you're intentional about it than you think you do. It's not, you don't have to wait for things around you all the time to change. You have a lot more power to regulate yourself when you practice that.
What a freedom. And so I'm going to go back for a second.
Freedom, that's a good phrase.
You took all 9 types and kind of brought their own ladder. And the ladder for those listening is the 3 parts of ventrovagal. It's a story of connection. Your sympathetic is a story of protection. And that's fight, freeze, and fawn. And then dorsal vagal is shut down. That's your story of disconnection, right? That's where you can't. Yeah, it means I can't. It means that everyone's better than me. We just become immobile. And it's protection, but it's also incredibly disconnected, right? So that's the latter. So the idea of you took each number in general and applied them to that, because neuroception, which means, you know, that we're always looking for cues of safety, threat, and danger.
Scanning for danger.
Scanning, right? But threat is different for people.
Yes.
A sense of
each
danger
number
is
scans for a very different thing. As an 8, you scan for not being in control, for people controlling you, for things like that, versus my 9 is of conflict and disconnect from the people and disconnect. But we're different things for us are threats.
Okay, that's what I want to hear. That's fascinating. What about a 4? I happen to be madly in love with a 4. So just curious. What's a threat for a 4? I would think inclusion.
The threat sort of goes back to the core fear of each number. And so the 4 is having no sense of identity, not being, as missing something. I'm missing something that's important. The sense of envy that comes from that from before. The threat is I'm missing something that everybody else has.
Right.
So I need to, does that make sense? So it's whether it's practically, emotionally, or whatever. So there's a fear that 4s have of not having a sense of identity. I'm different than everybody else. Something's broken in me.
Right. Okay. Yeah. No. That's really, really good. I don't think anybody else has done that, have they?
I don't think so. No. My colleague and I, we created it, and I feel I'm actually presenting virtually at the International Enneagram Association Global Conference this summer on that topic, which actually feels really cool.
Yeah. That's a huge honor.
That's what I was panicking and spinning about the other night. like midnight, I was like, I need to cancel. This is stupid. No, I have no idea what I'm talking about. Everybody's going to know. I need to just figure out some way to cancel this. That's what I was thinking that night. I was like, wait, I don't think I can trust this. Let me rethink this tomorrow.
good for you, right? Because it's something so big that's coming from your work.
It's huge. So vulnerable.
Yeah, but all the parts are like, I can't keep you safe if you're on stage. What are you doing?
Yes. It's like, we've been trying to keep you off stage your whole life to keep you safe. Why are you doing this?
What is your family, the 3, 7, 8, the aggressive stance? What do they think about the fact that you, the one who is a little more, obviously, withdrawn stance, but didn't crave the stage, where we know 3s definitely crave the stage,
You know what's interesting is there was a part, have you heard of the idea of the soul child with the Enneagram?
Yes.
You heard that? Okay, the soul child, meaning kind of how I was, how you were more as a kid. But you sort of deemed that part of you was unsafe, so you had to repress that part.
That's right.
For 9, it's the 3.
Yeah.
So as a younger kid, that's nines right. have that secret, like, I do want to be in the spotlight and I want to make a difference and make a splash and be seen, but it's so scary to do that. So there's like this, at the same time, there's a desire to.
Yeah.
Because I'm also very extroverted and I'm a social nine, which is a certain subtype that tends to be a little more extroverted and gregarious and things like that. And so I do like teaching and speaking, but every single time I do it, my butt sweats.
Yeah.
It's just my body responds every time. Oh, as much as I love doing it, my body responds every time.
Yeah, it's just doing its job. So with that, with the three sub-steps of, you know, subtypes are social, self-reserve, one-to-one, sexual. With what you came up with, is it also, you know, restricted or geared down to if you're a nine social, this is what the threat would look like?
I have not done that. I did that for a six because some people, I've heard people like to split six between phobic and counterphobic. Have you heard that before?
Oh, very much.
It's the same. That felt very important to show in those ladders because it's so different for each one.
So different.
That middle part, the fight or flight, like the fear and the threat is the same for every six. But how they handle it and when they go into fight or flight, what they do, whether it's fight or flight, is it can look very different for sixes. And so I split that up. But it's a really good idea.
Yeah.
I should look into that.
Yeah, and it'd be interesting to see how you even come up with that and what you do with it.
I can speak to every single subtype right now, so I think that's something I could absolutely create if I sat down to do it.
I believe in you. You're really good at this. All right, so let me tell you this story. I hadn't planned on telling you this. Of course, I don't plan on doing anything. I just show up.
Show up, just acting from your gut, like a true eight.
Like a good eight. So this is how my wife and I met, and even though some people believe I made this up just so I could spend time with her, but whatever. So here's my curiosity about people. So, you know, when we say hurt feelings, I don't think it's good communication. I really don't. So when someone says to me, "You hurt my feelings," I don't have any more information than before they said that. I really don't.
Wow, that's a great point.
Yeah.
It's like saying I'm doing good or bad. It's just not specific at all.
Great point. I don't know enough. If you say, "Hey, I felt invisible. I felt like you stepped on me." I can own that. I want lots of information because I don't want to do it again. Right. All that kind of stuff.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
So I told her, because again, she's a video producer, director, super smart. And so I would like to do some research on how each type interacts around the idea of their feelings being hurt. What does that mean? So if a one says, "You hurt my feelings," that's probably very different than if a seven says it.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Right? There'll be different feelings that were hurt, different meanings by it, different number. Yeah. That could be
different expectations based on their stance.
Sure, I can see some numbers even not ever sharing that your feelings got hurt to somebody, or some numbers oversharing that your feelings got hurt to somebody.
Right. And how a two would expect you to receive that you just hurt my feelings versus me as an eight, if I ever would say that, because I wouldn't.
Sure.
Right.
Sure. Yes.
Right. So anyway, so that was part of how we wanted to like really do surveys around that, find information, and then do like a video, almost like a group therapy, but each number. But COVID happened. Yeah, so we never did it, but still fell in love. I still conned her into marrying me. It all worked out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
It all worked out. Right. Yeah. But just sitting with that, that's why I'm so excited to hear about the polyvagal and you're doing that, because even things like each Enneagram number around idea of hurt feelings, like that's different.
And that's so much of what my Instagram is about, is like these things, these emotions, these therapy things, stuff like it looks so different. I've had posts about how different things are vulnerable for different numbers.
Yeah.
How just so many, like each number sees the world and feels things and experiences things so different. We can't just expect that everybody's the same. It's like we miss each other so much when we do that. That's my Instagram is full of basically that topic A, topic X, topic Z in therapy and how that relates differently to each number.
You and I can do an IG live.
Let's
over
do it.
Each number about hurt
feelings.
I would
be so down for that.
Yeah, that would be amazing because, again, I keep saying to people, like, first of all, clinically, I can't hurt your feelings. Feelings don't get hurt, right? But no one understands when I say that. No one believes me, Michael, because it makes sense to me. It's not.
What do you mean? Say more about what you mean by that.
So I have a feeling, right? And so it's part of my internal map, and it helps me know my level of safety and what's happening. I don't really feel like the feeling gets hurt. I feel like it's just an activation so that I can know what to do next.
It is a hurt, not a feeling being hurt. Is
the feeling. The feeling just got activated. I'm so literal. I can't imagine the feeling hurt. The feeling's not hurt.
More of like, I am hurt and now I have a feeling from that, as you're saying. But, it's kind of, yeah, you see that as more
feeling,
accurate.
The feeling is the indication that I need to take action.
That something is, yes, that a need isn't being met, that I'm...
Right, yeah, the need's not being met. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if this is just such an eight theme, because I think action, I think like, because I want to get into the solution. I do, and part of it's also...
Doing triad, and you're the one who's like the most intense in that. Yeah, so...
Doing triad, and I've been sober for 28 years, and so it's all about making amends. It's all about making things right, and making things right quickly.
Yeah,
right? For the sake of my sobriety, right? And so when someone... So I don't want to hurt people, but when they say... When people talk about hurt feelings... I think we think we're communicating the same, and we're not.
Yeah, yep, yes, absolutely. And it's, I wonder if it comes from a place of like, I don't know, like you hurt my feelings, like the same, like my feelings, like I feel hurt.
I feel
we're so bad at communicating our feelings and knowing what they're like and how to access that we just kind of use clunky language around it or something.
Right. Well, and think of this. So let's say a two says to a three, and then you go three, like you just hurt my feelings. Well, how a three can feel something but doesn't respond from feelings, think of the disconnect in that conversation.
You do know your stuff about the Enneagram. Yeah. Yeah, I could tell.
I've been around for a little while. Yeah.
But how different that like just interaction could be if they knew that they were coming from a different place, or to be able to communicate that better. Is that what you're saying?
Right, right. Mm-hmm. To have the verses of, so, all right, let me say this and I'll shut up about it. And I use this example all the time. So if I love football, and I don't anymore. I used to love it when I could play it and I could knock someone down and not go to jail. So there's an eight for you. Such an eight, right?
Yep. Yeah.
But let's say I love football, I love sports, and you don't. You're more arts, crafts, music. That's your thing. And I'm trying to get you to understand something I'm saying, and I use a sports analogy.
Sure.
I'm not considering you at all. But I'm expecting you. But I'm expecting you to get what I'm saying. Well, if I really want, if I have self awareness and I have capacity, I'm going to realize
need to hear it differently than what
I need to say. I need to use it, arts, music, something that works for you. If I'm really including you in the conversation, right?
Yes.
So I take that and extrapolate that to the Enneagram. So if I know your dependent stance, my conversation with you has to be. I need to honor that.
So when you're saying dependent stance, are you talking about, you mean withdrawn stance, you mean nines, or are you just using dependent stance?
Well, I just meant dependence one, two, and six, and you're withdrawn.
Perfect. I was just making sure that
I can say withdrawn. So if I know your withdrawn stance, then... Then
that's a very different way to communicate.
It's a different way.
Yeah, like that's for example, like withdrawn types, like nines, fives, and fours, they can very frequently not text people back, not respond to people.
Right.
And then other like more assertive types, like that must mean, so it's easy for me to respond to people. Mm-hmm. You're not. So without self-awareness, that must mean you don't like me, because if I didn't respond to somebody, that would mean I hate them. And so that must mean you feel the same thing, when that could be very not true.
Right.
Just without that self-awareness and knowing that, like, just because I think that and this is how I would react or feel or respond to the situation does not at all clue me in how somebody else is feeling, just because they're doing the same thing at all.
You got it. That's perfect. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And so it's part of why I love the Enneagram, and I'm sure it's part of why you fell in love with it too.
Especially because, with couples therapy. It's huge to show
the vocabulary and understanding each other and doing the shadow work and knowing all the things, right? Yeah, it makes such a difference.
Yeah, so great example. I have a client who one's a nine and one's a one. And the wife's a one and the husband's a nine, and she gets so frustrated with him not cleaning things up.
Yeah.
He's like, she's like, he can just walk past things and not care and like he doesn't see it. But I think he's probably doing that on purpose to make me pick it all up.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And then I was like, let's leave room for that being a possibility.
Yeah.
And nines, that defense mechanism is this numbing out, dissociating, narcotizing. Like I can just numb out to anything. I'm so good at it. And so it's like, it's actually so possible that he really is just numbing out, which doesn't mean that's great and needs to be allowed all the time in the relationship, right? He needs to hear her and what she needs too.
Right.
But just to say like, hey, it's, you can't make meaning that he's doing that on purpose so easily, as easily as you think you can, basically.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. That's you just keying up on that, about that she makes meaning out of it.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah. Like you make a narrative out of it. You create meaning out of it that isn't necessarily true. That happens all the time. With some of my major work as a couple is like, wait, pause. Yeah. What did you just hear him say? It's probably wrong what you think. And then but she thinks it's right. They both think it's right. They both think they know exactly what the other person's doing and why, and their motivations and everything.
But they don't. Yeah, I love that. You're so smart. Do you think that's the number one thing you see in marriages that starts the disconnect of the idea of, I've decided for you that this is the story and this is why you're doing it.
Yeah, that and a sense of like codependency. So having to emotionally manage each other, right? Yes. So I don't want you to feel this, so I'm not going to share this because I don't want you to feel that. Because it's just, that is, I see that everywhere. Like, right, I knew she was going to be upset. I knew she didn't want to be at that bar for very long. And so I told her I wanted to leave early so she wasn't upset. I remember this couple, he said, because I love her and want to take care of her. And I was like, I don't think it's about her actually in this moment. And
you.
I was pretty direct. I said, so what happens if you stayed and didn't do that? He said, then I'll get an earful on the way home. I said, oh, so it's actually about your comfort level on the way home.
There you go.
Not about taking care of her. It felt great. It felt great to be that direct with him that time.
Well, and
but it's
also
sort of the what are you saying?
Yeah, well, you saying that is actually what most therapists wouldn't say.
Yeah. It feels difficult to say. I think early on in my career, I wouldn't have said something that direct at all.
Yeah. Well, it's also the insight to see what's really going on.
To see that what's going on under the surface and like what's, and be able to call people out. And there's a lot of times when you really hit it, there's a resistance. He was like, no, it's not about me. I'm like, usually if it's an instant, then there's probably some.
It's really
like,
about you.
Yeah. The other day, this week, the beginning of this week, I had a client say she had to reschedule, and she said, she showed up and she said, "I'm so sorry if this was your only. I was really stressed rescheduling because I was worried this would be your only free hour on your calendar, and I don't want to take it up." Mm. And I said, "I think that's probably my responsibility to make sure I'm taking breaks throughout the day."
Yeah.
I said, "It sounds like you're trying to take care of me." She's like, "No, I'm not at all," and denied it two or three times.
Yeah.
And I was like, tell me what that is if it's not trying to take care of me.
Right. Yeah. And I get that all the time and try to use that as a teaching moment to be with them.
Yes, just in the moment. Yeah. Just in the now, what's happening right now with you and your thoughts about me. That's such good stuff for therapy.
Yeah, it is. And I'll throw this, this is one thing that comes up a lot. And you just said the same thing. I just think you say it probably in a way that people can grasp it better. I probably sound a little bit harsher. But when people bring up the whole thing of, well, I'm not going to tell my husband that because it'll upset him, then I really say, well, I need you to grasp what that's a childlike narcissism. You're deciding that you have emotional capacity to hold something and that your husband doesn't have capacity.
Wow. Yeah. Right? Yep.
And if you decide that, it will be true because they'll never build that muscle.
Yes, and you're robbing them of the opportunity to build
that
muscle. And you're giving this underlying message of you are too weak. You're weak enough
that
you can't handle this.
That's
I have
exactly
to take care
right.
of you, which makes this, that's instead right. of a peer relationship, it's a parent-child relationship, which is not fun, not sexy, not fulfilling.
Right.
None of that.
None of that. Boom. You got it. Yeah. You're such a good therapist.
Thank you. I. You know what? Had you told me that a while back, lately I will absolutely own that. I think I'm really, really good at what I do. And that's that if I really think about how many people might hear me saying that on your podcast, I start to get a little sweaty.
Yeah.
But we're just going to not think about that right now.
We're just going to sweat a little bit about that. But it really is true. I don't want to see a doctor who doesn't think they're good. No, I don't need some narcissistic and arrogant.
That's
but
a great
I tell,
point.
Yeah. Like I want some, I tell people, I've done this for a long time and I do it well. It doesn't mean I'm going to do it well with you. And if I can't do it well with you, I want you to find someone else. But I am good at what I do.
Yep. That's a great point. I love that.
Yeah. So good.
And I think as a nine, especially, I can see. It can be easy for nines to see confidence as arrogance, narcissism. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
When I had a friend who's a one tell me, I think he said, if you're a nine, you think you're being arrogant, 99% chance you're actually not.
That's a really good way of putting that. That's a good thing for all nines to hear that.
Yeah. Like for me, and what shift that for me is me being confident is not saying that somebody else is incompetent.
Right.
It's not a zero-sum game. It's not a slice of a pie. If I take a bigger one, somebody else gets less. And that actually means a lot to me. That's because it's like, oh, cool. I'm not saying I'm better than other people. I'm just saying I'm good at this. And if you take that as me saying I'm better than you, that's actually not my problem.
That's completely on them. It's kind of like if I say no to somebody, I'm not taking away their request being fulfilled. I'm just saying I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. Wow. Which, man, there's so much safety in people who can set boundaries like that, for me at least. It's like I know that if I ask for something and you say yes, and I know you've said no before, then I can fully trust that and not have to be worried that you're just doing it to appease me or something, because I know you have the ability to say no.
Yeah. One of my favorite quotes is from John Lee. He's the author of Growing Yourself Back Up. It's a great book. He's a friend of mine, and he said, I can't trust your yes if you can't tell me no.
Tell me no. Yep.
Love that.
It doesn't mean anything. Yeah, your yes doesn't mean anything if you can't say no.
That's right.
It's great. Yeah. It's a I guess so. It's not a yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a I'm too young right now to give any answer, but yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right.
Yes.
Yeah, good deal. All right, you're amazing. I'm going to put you in the hot seat real quick. You're a therapist, so here we go. Here's some simple little questions for you for us to close out. You ready? Okay, whatever comes to mind first. All right, what do you like better, dogs, cat, or people?
I was going to say dogs if it was just those two, but dogs, if I had an answer quick, because I hate cats, so that's an easy answer.
Right. Yeah, all right, dogs
are the best. Let's say people.
Okay. All right, we'll say people. All right, we're going with people. Dogs are a close second is what I'm hearing you say.
And cats are a very far third.
Very far. I was raised to hate cats. Completely.
They're the worst.
Raised.
They think they're so much better than you.
Yeah, and they have no need for me, so
yes,
whatever.
Exactly.
Right? They don't need me. They're hilarious, though. All right, if you could have any superpower, what would you pick?
Be able to slow down time.
Oh, I like that.
I know growing up, like when I was playing baseball, it's like I could slow down time as the pitch came in and I could knock it out of the park every time. Or I could slow down time and think through things or learn a lot or practice something. So for me, slowing down time was always the answer.
Oh, I like that. All right, this is a little bigger question. What do you want your legacy to be?
It's just a simple question, no big deal. What do I want my legacy to be?
Yeah.
I think that's a big question. I think my best answer would be somebody who models vulnerability and realness and gives people permission to admit to be vulnerable. And to be real with themselves and other people. Yeah, giving themselves permission. I like that a lot. No matter what I do, whether it's modeling it or teaching, I want to give people permission to be able to do that. And feel the freedom in that.
There is great freedom in that. I like it. Last question for you. What is your favorite book?
It's my favorite book. Probably have to go with a nerdy answer. I love a lot of fantasy and sci-fi. I could go like the therapy answer and do some therapy book, but it's called King Killer Chronicles by Patrick Rothfuss. I have reread it, audiobook, probably 9 or 10 times. There's two books. He hasn't come out with a third, and so I just love to reread it and think of what could happen in the third. I love it. The world he creates, the way he writes.
That's good. I love that.
Love it.
And I love you. You're amazing. You're one of my new best friends. I hope you know that.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Thank you for telling
me. Yeah, we're saying that. We're letting the whole world know simultaneously. You're finding out when everybody else is finding out. So how great is that? Fantastic. All right. So if people wanted to continue being part of your vulnerability and your purpose, how would they contact you and find you?
My Instagram is probably my biggest kind of space that I exist online in. It's to my handle. It's Michael Shahan _therapy.
Yeah.
That's my handle. So Instagram.com/Michael_therapy and my website, MichaelShahan.com. I have all my events that I'm doing, courses that I'm teaching, previous courses recorded that are being sold. Where everybody is at and I'm most active on it would be my Instagram.
All right. I love that. So y'all find him on Instagram. You will learn a whole lot. And so thank you, Michael. This has been so much fun.
Yes, I've loved this a lot.
Yeah, this has been really good. And to all the listeners, I know you've heard numerous things today that will help you reconnect to who you actually are. And we'll see y'all next time.
Thank you for listening to Flip Your Lid with Kim Honeycutt. Please subscribe, rate, and share. You can find Kim on Facebook or Instagram at KB Honeycutt. To get an autographed copy of Kim's book, visit butyourmotherlovesyou.com. Remember, no matter what, treat yourself well today.